You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's Friday, so it's Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Senator Sanders, you are here?
I am right here. How are you, Tom?
I am just great. I understand that the Senate may begin voting and you may be pulled away.
Right. We are dealing with the budget right now. There are going to be dozens and dozens of amendments taking place. We'll probably be here to the early hours of the morning, so we may be called away or we may not.
Okay.
We will see.
All right. So your thoughts on the last, you know, since we last spoke last week, what's going on in the Senate?
Well, mostly what's been going on is a lot of budget discussion. And the issue is really not complicated. Congressman Ryan, who is chairman of the House Budget Committee, has presented his budget, which is an unmitigated disaster. What his budget basically says is that we're going to balance the budget in 10 years by making horrendous cuts in virtually every program that working families depend upon. We're going to end over a period of time Medicare as we know it, massive cuts in Medicaid, throw millions of people, men, women, and children, off of that program, cuts in education, cuts in nutrition, you name the program. They're going to cut that. And we're also, by the way, as we cut programs for ordinary people, we're going to lower the tax rates for the wealthiest people in this country. I mean, that's what right-wing republicanism is about, tax breaks for the wealthiest people and massive cuts for working families. I'm on the budget committee, so I've been working for the last couple of weeks as an independent with the Democratic caucus, working with Senator Murray, who's the chair of the Democratic budget committee, and what we're on the floor doing right now is going over that budget. Some of the amendments that I'm going to be offering are, number one, at a time when corporate profits are at record-breaking levels and the effective tax rate that corporations are paying is the lowest since 1972, when you have one out of four major profitable corporations paying nothing in taxes. You know, when we're losing about $100 billion every year because these companies are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and in other tax havens. And when you have just incredible outrages out there, you have entities like Bank of America making huge profits, setting up several hundred subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands to avoid taxes, not paying any taxes. General Electric, during the last 5 years, made $81 billion in profit. Not only did it pay nothing in taxes, federal taxes, during that period, it got a $3 billion rebate from the IRS. You got Citigroup, paid no federal income taxes for the last 5 years after being bailed out by the taxpayers of this country. So you got outrage after outrage after outrage. And our Republican friends and some Democrats don't want to address that issue. What they much prefer to do is talk about cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, nutrition, and all of the programs that impact working families. So that is what the debate is about. The Murray budget, the Senate Democratic budget, is far, far, far more preferable to the House budget. It does not go anywhere near as far as it should. We got 14% of our population today is truly unemployed, counting those who have given up looking for work, those who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. We've got $100 billion in there to rebuild the infrastructure. That's much too little. We need to be creating millions and millions of jobs, putting our people, including young people, back to work. And we can do that through infrastructure, through transforming our energy system. So what we have is a disastrous budget in the House, a much better budget in the Senate, but not good enough. And I'm going to try to make it a little bit better this afternoon.
Yeah, I understand that there was even a vote on a piece of legislation that in the Senate that said we expressly to establish a deficit neutral reserve fund to protect Medicare's guaranteed benefits and to prohibit replacing guaranteed benefits with the House passed budget plan to turn Medicare into a voucher program. And three senators, Cruz, Lee, and Rand Paul, voted in, against this. In other words,
these guys
want a voucher program?
Of course they want a voucher program. In fact, many of them, the vast majority of the Republicans support the Rand budget. What we are engaged in, and I hope the American people know it, is certainly in the modern history of this country, is an unprecedented level of class warfare. I've mentioned this before a couple of weeks ago, the Business Roundtable, which consists of the heads of the largest corporations in America, all of whom are profitable. All of these CEOs make millions of dollars a year in compensation. All of them have wonderful retirement packages. And they came forward and they said, we should raise the Medicare eligibility age to 70. We should raise the Social Security eligibility age to 70. These are the wealthiest CEOs in the country making that proclamation. So what we are seeing in America now and have seen for many years is a massive transfer of wealth from middle-income and working families to the wealthiest people in this country. We've got 46 million people living in poverty. We have the rich and large corporations paying effectively very low tax rates. And that's the dynamic of where we are today. And that's what has got to change if we are going to preserve the middle class. And one area we are working very hard is this absurdity of allowing these corporations to stash their money in tax havens in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, elsewhere around the world where they pay zero in taxes, and which contributes to the deficit problem we have in our country today.
Senator, I know you're now on the Veterans Affairs Committee, if I have that right, the name of it correctly.
Yes.
What's being done to do away with this, in many cases, 600-day backlog for veterans to just get their applications for
benefits approved? Well, we have a serious problem, and I don't want to understate the problem. The truth is that the VA right now is processing more claims than they ever have before. They're processing about 1 million claims a year. Problem is, because we've opened up the system appropriately, so a lot of Vietnam vets have been able to get compensation or applying for compensation service benefits, service-connected benefits, because of exposure to Agent Orange. And in other areas, we have now 1.2 million benefits a year coming in. So the good news is the VA is now processing more claims than ever before. The bad news is that they're unable to keep up with the unprecedented number of claims that are coming in. Also, what is going on is, for the first time, what the VA is trying to do, what should have been done a long, long time ago, but has only really begun about 4 years ago when General Shinseki became head of the VA, is to convert these enormous paper files. I mean, you got, for some veterans, you have a file that goes from the floor to the ceiling, to convert that paper into the digital world.
Right.
And create a paperless system. So it's a complicated issue. They are making progress. Clearly, there are serious problems that remain, serious backlogs that remain.
Is the sequester slowing this down?
Sequester is not hitting the VA. It is hitting other programs which impact veterans, but not the VA per se.
Okay. Pardon my interrupting you. I just...
No, not at all. It's a huge issue. And I'd love to hear from veterans out there about ways we can improve the VA. We had two hearings. One of them was just on this issue, Tom, the backlog. And the second issue was on veterans' health care. We remain very concerned about the number of suicides that the veterans community is experiencing and the many folks coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. Huge problems which we are attempting to get our hands around.
It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. I think of him as America's senator. Vermonters know he's theirs. Lucky guys. Check out sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. You can sign the various petitions on his website.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can also keep up with the news, the general, good political news of what's going on in America, all over at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more Bernie, taking your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders over at the Senate Television Studios here with us. And Larry, in Franklin, North Carolina, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, and Senator, I'd like to thank you for your for all the work that you do in Congress. But my deal is that I don't understand that why we can't use our taxpayers' money from the local, state, and federal government when we purchase things to run our government. Why can't we have that product made in the United States? You know, even if made by foreign companies, they should come to the United States and make the products that we got to use in our schools, in our courthouses, and everything else. Why do we
Larry, thanks very much for that question. And this is an issue that Tom and I have discussed over the years, and I agree with you absolutely. Here's what the story is. Not only is corporate America working desperately to avoid paying their fair share of taxes by putting their money in tax havens, what they have done for many, many years is support trade policies which allow them to shut down in America, move to China, Vietnam, Mexico, other low-wage countries to manufacture their products, and then bring these products back into this country with either low tariffs or no tariffs at all. And that has been, that's what NAFTA is about, that's what CAFTA is about, that's what permanent normal trade relations with China is about, that's what a new Pacific Rim trade agreement is also about. This is corporate America basically saying, why do I want to pay an American worker $15-$20 an hour, provide health insurance, protect the environment, when I can go to countries like China, pay pennies an hour, don't worry about the environment, don't worry about unions, that's where I want to go. That's what these trade agreements have been about. Last 10 years, we have lost over 50,000 factories in America, not all of it due to trade, but a lot of it due to these trade agreements. And we've got to stop that. Now, what I have done is work with, among other things, the Smithsonian Institute, which previously in their gift shops and their online purchases, online catalogs, was selling a lot of products made abroad. We've put pressure on them and asked them to do the right thing and reach out to American companies, and they have. We're seeing a transformation there. As chairman of the Veterans Committee, we are right now working with the VA to make sure that the products they use and that they sell in their gift shops and elsewhere are, to as great a degree as possible, made in America. But we have got to continue that effort. Corporate America will go wherever wages are lowest in the world, wherever they can get away with environmental degradation and not have to clean up their factories. And we have got to say to them, sorry, if you want us to purchase your products, you should start rebuilding the manufacturing base here in America, create decent jobs here in this country. It is a huge issue, and it's something we've got to focus on. But I'll give you the tell you the truth, because the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturing are so powerful, and they have tremendous power over the Republican Party, considerable power over the Democratic Party and the White House. I wouldn't hold my breath as we move in that direction. But, Larry, that is exactly what we have to do.
Jim, in Lake Forest, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Jim, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator. I just wondered, since everybody, well, first off, since all economists virtually and history, and now even Republicans admit we do not have an immediate shortage or budget deficit, why can't we, why can't they propose that the president really come out and say, look, then what we have to do is there will be no cuts until an economic trigger is hit, and we are going to keep investing in the economy, and when we hit 6%, let's say, unemployment for four quarters in a row, and GDP goes up, let's say, 2% that can be negotiated, then and only then we consider any kind of cuts that are not, that are anything other than just cleaning up corruption or waste or whatnot. Now, that just seems to me like a lot of, and then put it on the Republicans and say, look, if you don't go for this, it seems that you're trying to destroy the economy. I mean, why wouldn't you go for this? If you go for this, you know, you prove you don't, you put them on the defense and say, prove you don't try to destroy
well,
the economy.
Well, Jim, that is a, first of all, let me just say from Jim's lips to Barack Obama's ears. I think Jim, in a very clear and articulate way, told us very much what we have got to do. For a start, what many people don't know is that the deficit has gone down over the last few years from $1.4 trillion to about $850 billion, and the projection is it is going to continue to go down. That's still a lot of money, and that's in addition or on top of a $16-plus trillion national debt. Those are real issues. I don't want to sweep them under the rug. But what Jim is saying absolutely correctly is that before you start cutting education, Social Security, veterans programs, Medicare, Medicaid, before you start cutting, and by the way, when you do that, laying off American workers, what we have to do is deal with a more serious problem, that real unemployment is over 14% and even higher among our young people and people of color. And what Jim is saying, and I agree with him, we have got to invest. Our infrastructure is crumbling. State of Vermont, a very significant percentage of our bridges are in serious disrepair. That's true all over this country. Everybody who drives roads in virtually every community in America knows that we need to improve our roads and highways. Everybody knows that our rail system is way behind Europe, Japan, even China, that we have to create a first-class rail system for passengers and for cargo. Travel in airports. You see how outdated many of the airports are. We have to invest in infrastructure, and when you do that, you can create millions of jobs. Put people back to work. When they're back to work, they are paying taxes, by the way, and that helps us with deficit reduction. The other issue that we have to deal with is the crisis of global warming. We had a town meeting in Montpelier, Vermont, just last week. We had Bill McKibben, one of the leading experts on global warming, doing a great job raising consciousness. 600 people were out. We have to invest in sustainable energy and in energy efficiency. Put people back to work doing that as well.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders here taking your calls, at least unless there's a vote in the Senate. Might pull him away, but for right now, he's here with us. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for the Bernie Buzz. It's a hoot. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. You're still here, Senator?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. Paul in Sparta, Wisconsin, watching on DirecTV on Free Speech TV. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you, sir. Senator Sanders, thank you for sticking around and listening to some problems. I have two questions on the sequester. The first one is, are you all going to do anything to try to stop this? I can't afford, as a government employee, I can't afford to take an $800 a month pay cut. I have a mortgage, a car payment, a kid in school. And, you know, I've done 38 years with the federal government, and I don't want to retire right yet. And my second question is, if this is supposed to be shared sacrifice between all federal employees, why aren't the congressmen and senators taking a 20% pay cut just like I have to?
Okay, let me answer your first question. As somebody who voted against the legislation which enabled sequestration from taking place, some of us, you know, when you say you guys, that always, as Tom knows, that always gets me upset. There is no you guys. There are two separate political parties. There are 100 members of the Senate, each who have different points of view. So, don't lump me in with some of these right-wing guys who have proposals out there, by the way, to substantially cut back on federal employees, the number of federal employees, to cut back on wages, to cut back on benefits. There are some people who want to do that, and there are some of us who are trying to protect and fight for federal employees. And it's important that employees understand who is what, who's working with the unions, fighting with the unions for workers' rights, and who wants to really shrink the federal government, working not only to protect federal employees, but the U.S. Postal Service workers as well. So in terms of your question is, are some of us trying to do anything? We are. As a matter of fact, that's what we're doing right at this minute. That's what the budget resolution is all about. But the budget resolution, which is on the floor right now, and where there may be votes in 15 minutes, for which I'll have to leave this program, deals just with this issue. Now, in my view, sequestration was a disaster, and the reason that federal employees are furloughed is because the Republicans demanded that no new revenue come in. It was $1.1 trillion over 10 years of cuts. And if that's all you do, you got to make very painful cuts. And one of them is furloughing public employees. So to answer Paul's question, that is precisely what is taking place right now. It is the attempt to develop a budget to replace sequestration, which, among other things, would end the furloughing of federal employees.
Craig in Orlando, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you. Senator, I'm glad that you're defending us postal workers, but unfortunately, I think the Postmaster General is ignoring you gentlemen because they are speeding up the closure of my workplace down in Central Florida, and they're not giving us any offers of jobs in the area. They're saying, we'll get you a couple of jobs, but you might have to go somewhere else a couple hundred miles away or anything else. Can't do that. I have a son that's in high school, wife and everything else, been doing this for 25 years. And they're telling a lot of these guys, either take the job that's wherever or you're furloughed. And we're in a panic right now because we feel like we're being ignored. And because of, you know, Congressman Issa's little hostage crisis with his bill, we're quite frankly, we don't know which end is up anymore.
Okay. Well, Craig, thanks very much for calling. And, you know, Craig is saying the same thing that Paul of Wisconsin just said. And I want everybody to understand this. And, you know, what upset me a little bit about Paul's question is this, you guys. And when you talk about you guys and assuming that everybody in the Congress is coming from the same place, that's dumb. That's wrong. Here's what's going on. Some of us believe that the United States government should be playing an active role in making sure that programs are provided to people who need them, whether that is education, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, nutrition, whatever, that it is the federal government that helps people get an education, helps them with retirement, helps them when they are sick. We have a party in the House now in control, the right-wing Republicans, who have a very different point of view. They believe the private sector should do those things or not do them at all. And if people do not have any health insurance because you've made massive cuts in Medicaid or Medicare, not a problem. If people can't afford to go to college, not a problem. If older people who have limited incomes can't get Meals on Wheels or nutrition programs, not a problem. Working families can't afford child care, not a problem. So what you have is one party trying to eviscerate what the federal government does, and when you do that, you also lay off of workers. Now, in terms of the Postal Service, we dealt, I think it was a year and a half ago, with a proposal from the Postmaster General. And what he said, I want to shrink the Postal Service in the middle of this recession by some 200,000 workers. I want to shut down half of the rural post offices in America. I want to shut down half of the processing plants in America. I want to slow mail delivery. And some of us said, sorry, we think that's a dumb idea. You're not going to do it. Well, we didn't get everything that we wanted, but we stopped them from doing what they wanted to do. They didn't shut down 15,000 rural post offices. In fact, what they did, which I'm not happy about, is cut back on hours, not great, but better than shutting them down. And they shut down far fewer processing plants that they wanted. So Craig asked, where are we right now? And where you are right now is, Craig, last year, the Senate passed a bill, which didn't go as far as I would like, but it was a fairly good bill, and I voted for it, which addresses the major problem facing the Postal Service. And that is that about 75 to 80% of the financial problems of the Post Office have to do with the onerous burden, financial burden, placed on the Postal Service in 2006 by the Bush administration, saying that they have to fund 75 years of retiree health benefits in a 10-year period, $5.5 billion every single year. You get rid of that burden, you go a long way to stabilizing the finances of the Postal Service, and that's what we've done, and that's what we're focusing on. So we're working on a bill here in the Senate, and I'll be actively involved in that. We hope that the House will go along with our version. And if we do that, I'm not going to tell Craig there won't be pain. There will be. But it'll be a heck of a lot worse than what the Postmaster General and what the Republicans originally wanted.
Zach in Manassas, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I wanted to thank you for telling him that he's wrong.
Zach, your phone is breaking up really badly. I'm only hearing every third word.
Okay, I'm sorry. Maybe is this,
that's
this
better.
Is better?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I just want to thank you for trying to hold these corporations accountable and try to make them pay taxes. It's really, really inspiring to hear that kind of rhetoric from a senator. I mean, it's kind of it's super important that these huge billion-dollar corporations pay their...
Zach, your phone's still breaking up. What's your question for Bernie?
I just wanted to know if he supported apartheid in Israel.
Okay.
Well,
let
me just say this about the banks. Here's some good news. Right now there's a break. We were supposed to, by the way, Tom, have votes at 2:30. It is now 3:45, and there are still no votes, so I'm not sure exactly what's going on the floor there. Mm-hmm. But one of the positive things is my understanding, I won't swear to you, is that on one of the amendments, very similar to one that I'm offering, dealing with these tax havens in the Cayman Islands and so forth, we think that maybe John McCain has come aboard that. And that's important. That'll be the first Republican aboard, and I think we may get others. This is a huge, huge issue because you've heard people calling up federal employees saying, you know, we can't survive a 20% reduction in our wages. And they're absolutely right. And the way you address that is by bringing in more revenue. Revenue now, as a percentage of GDP in this country, is at the lowest point it has been in some 60 years. And one way you bring in revenue is demand that many of these corporations, Bank of America, General Electric, Citigroup, Verizon, Honeywell International, Merck, Corning, Boeing, Dow Chemical, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Microsoft, all of these companies are taking advantage and many more of these tax havens, and they're either paying nothing in federal income taxes or very, very little, much less than they should. So we've got to keep the pressure on, and we've got to get Democrats on board this. We've got to get Republicans on board. And when you do that, we can bring in revenue that will result in ending these absurd cuts that are hurting so many people.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. We have just 2 seconds to the break here. Here we go. You're going to be with us for the next 15 minutes, Senator?
So far, it looks like I will.
Okay, great. We're going to take more phone calls for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this, 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. If you have questions you couldn't get through on the air, you can communicate them to him via his website as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Also, one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, brought to you by Stamps.com. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Well, Bernie had to, literally a minute and a half ago, they came in and they said, okay, the voting's starting, and he was coming in from the Senate television studios, which is just a short walk to his office, to the Capitol, but you know, to where they vote, the Senate chambers, I guess it's called. And so he had to boogie out of the chair. And so if you're on hold and you have a question for Bernie, please just hang up and call back next week. On the other hand, we'll begin Anything Goes Friday right now. If there's any topic you want to bring up that I could riff on or answer your comments or questions to, or you just want to, you know, let off some steam on your own topics, feel free. That's what Anything Goes Friday is all about. So, but, you know, if you start out with, I had a question for Bernie, then I'll just move along to the next call. Frank in Newego, Michigan. Hey, Frank, home of my grandparents.
Hello, hi, how you doing?
Just great. I spent a lot of summers in Newego when I was growing up. It's a beautiful town.
Yeah. Okay. Hello, Tom?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on the air. Yes. Or you're on the air. We're on the air.
Okay. All right, great. What I want to know is, why is it that our government is not using solar systems, especially solar panels, in our federal buildings and county buildings and
right.
city buildings, which would also help bring down the cost of those particular solar panels so that people will be able to afford them in their house? Because I understand that they said it's so high now because it's such a new thing. But the more you use it,
cheaper it gets.
Price.
Yeah. Here's the problem, Frank. And in fact, solar power is now down to the point where if you look at over a 10-year period, the cost of putting solar in versus using any other form of electricity, it pretty much washes out. In many cases, it's cheaper. The problem is the initial investment, and that requires governments to spend money that they're not going to immediately make back. They're going to make it back over a 10-year period. It's called an investment, and Republicans don't understand investment. They only understand expense, and they look at that cost, and they say, oh, that's an expense. You are absolutely right. It would be a brilliant thing to do. It's what Jimmy Carter did with the White House. He put solar panels on the White House I think that they were hot water panels, actually. I'm not sure, even sure that they were photovoltaic, but he had solar panels on the White House and, you know, to capture some of the sun's energy and help heat up some of the water in the White House. And Ronald Reagan took them down and shipped them off. In fact, it was just last year somebody discovered them at some college someplace and brought them back to the White House. But I think it would be a great idea if government started using solar panels, but it would take an initial investment. You would have to spend a little more money, and right now there are very few states that have a little extra money because we're in a recession, and so the tax receipts are not what they used to be. And at the federal level, the Republicans will shoot this down. Absolutely. No way they're going to let it happen. So, Frank, that's the answer. I'm sorry. It's not a better news story. David in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually a retired Navy, so
I
understand the pain that's going on with all the sequester and what potentially is going to come about. But
yeah.
My question was about the filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand. I do understand cloture and the pre-vote, I guess is what you'd call it,
mm-hmm.
to take a vote to the floor of the Senate. But if it's not working, then why is it that the Senate Majority Leader doesn't just bring the legislation to the floor for a vote and start the filibuster process?
Okay. In order for under current Senate rules, my understanding of this, and I'm not a Senate parliamentarian, so I may have this wrong, but my understanding of it is that before a bill can be voted on, it has to be debated. And there has to be a vote to begin debate, there has to be a vote to end debate. And either one of those two votes can be objected to, and Republicans regularly do. Ending debate is called cloture, you know, closing the debate.
Right.
Beginning the debate is got some other word associated with it. I think it's just beginning the debate or bring it forward for debate. And they will very often object to that as well. And under the current Senate rules, one senator objects. You have to get 60 senators to say, I don't object, and move it forward. Harry Reid had proposed that there just be a small change where it would take 40 senators to object. In other words, you'd have to, if one senator wanted to try and block the process moving forward to debate and then ending debate so that you can have a vote, it would take 40 senators. He ultimately did not even make that change, which I thought was tragic. And of course, the better change would have been to say, you know, majority rules, which is what it says in the Constitution. So the question is Harry Reid going to change the rules? Yesterday, he and Dick Durbin were complaining about the fact that the Republicans are not playing by the agreement that they made when Harry Reid shook hands with Mitch McConnell back at the first of the year and said, okay, you know, Mitch McConnell said, I promise we will not filibuster anything unless it's like, you know, country changing crisis stuff. And Mitch McConnell lied. Surprise, surprise. He'd been lying for 4 years.
Understood that.
Yeah.
We've all heard it.
Yeah. So that's the bottom line. I mean, you know, the Republicans are just continuing to play these games. Harry Reid thought he had good faith. I think hopefully he's realizing that he had bad faith. Or maybe he also was looking at it and saying, you know, if I burn through all my political capital right now blowing up the filibuster, it won't make any difference because the Republicans control the House of Representatives, even though Democrats got 1.5 million more votes in the election of 2012 in the House of Representatives than Republicans. The Republicans still control the House, so, you know, thanks to gerrymandering. And because they control the House, even if we were to get good legislation out of the Senate, it will die in the House. So let's wait another 2 years, keep our powder dry, burn through the political capital then, if the Democrats can take the House in the midterm elections. And I think that there's a chance that they will. Republicans increasingly are putting their foot in their mouths. People are looking at things like the Ryan budget. I don't know if you saw the polling on this, but, you know, Paul Ryan's popularity is down there.
Right,
with,
and then the comments about trying to destroy Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did have one comment also. Term limits. I mean, we've got them for the president, and they brought that to brought that about to prevent, you know, power from corrupting.
No, we brought that about. The Republicans brought that about to stop there being another Franklin Roosevelt. And I personally am an opponent of term limits at any level. I think we have something called term limits. It's called elections. And the problem with term limits in Congress is that if you term limit out members of Congress, what is the institutional memory that remains? It's lobbyists. Also, who can afford to become a congressman for just 4 years? Only rich people.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the place where we're taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. I saw over at Democratic Underground, I saw a headline, an article that said, the one financial stat I'd love everyone to memorize, this is from Reformist 2, the one financial stat I'd love everyone to memorize, the net worth of Americans is $64 trillion. And there's a link from this to the FederalReserve.gov site where they have the flow of funds report on household net worth, and the figures are in the summary statistics. America is an incredibly rich nation. The next time you hear some bozo say, oh, we can't afford that, we're broke. The net worth of Americans, not $64 million, not $64 billion, $64 trillion. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. $26 trillion of that trillion is held by the top 1%. 80% of that, 80% of that $64 trillion, which would be, what, a little more than $40 trillion, 80% of that, 40 some, I can't do the math that fast, it would be 64 minus roughly 17 trillion. 80% of that is held by the top 10% of Americans. Which is pretty amazing. But anytime somebody says, oh, we're broke, we can't afford that. Sorry. The net worth of Americans, $64 trillion. And, you know, 80% of that with the top 10%. I'm not saying we should confiscate it, although I am a proponent of ending billionaires, saying, you know, a billion's enough to live on, personal wealth. Anything beyond that, we'll have a wealth tax. NoBillionaires.com. Terry in Youngsville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Terry, welcome to Anything Goes Friday.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wondered if you ever read an article called How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich by Tim Dickerson. It was in Rolling Stone magazine, and it really lays out well how Dick Cheney hijacked the Bush's presidency in order to enable the rich to save on taxes. And
And to help and Halliburton survive. I mean, Halliburton was on the verge of bankruptcy when Dick Cheney became vice president. And now, after all these no-bid contracts, they're one of the wealthiest corporations probably in America, and certainly around the world. I saw the article. I read pieces of it. I skimmed it. I didn't read it word for word. I would say, though, that really the Republican Party became the party of the rich in the late 1870s, early 1880s, when they were corrupted by the railroad barons. There was an attempt by progressives to take back the Republican Party, because originally it was a progressive party. You know, when Abe Lincoln signed up in 1860, it was started in 1856 in Jackson, Michigan. And, you know, originally it was a progressive party. Then it was hijacked by the railroad barons in the 1870s, 1880s. And then in 1901, when McKinley was assassinated, his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, was a closet progressive, and he came out and started pushing progressive perspectives. And the progressives came back, and you had progressive Republicans right up through the early 1920s. And by the time of the presidency of Warren Harding, they had pretty much stamped out all the progressives from the Republican Party. And it had once again become exclusively the party of the rich, and it's pretty much stayed that way ever since. Make sense?
That's really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's what's happened, and there was this kind of dark period where you had one president, Grover Cleveland, was the only Democrat elected president from the time of the Civil War, after Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's vice president was a Democrat, and so of course they tried to impeach him. From that time until Woodrow Wilson, you didn't have another Democratic president other than Grover Cleveland. And Grover Cleveland, in his 1887 State of the Union address, came right out and said it, that because of the corporate form, because of these trusts and combinations, the wealthy now have an iron heel on the neck of average Americans. I encourage you to go read it. I've written about it several times. If you just Google Tom Hartman and Grover Cleveland, it'll probably pop up. Or Grover Cleveland Iron Heel, you'll get it. Or just, read Grover Cleveland's 1887 State of the Union address. But then, and he was a Democrat, and he was elected twice, and they weren't consecutive terms, interestingly enough. There was a Republican in between. And, but that's kind of the thumbnail history of the Republican Party. And in modern days, it's gotten much more toxic, certainly with Dick Cheney. I wouldn't disagree with Tim Dickerson. But, the Republican Party has always been the party of the rich. Dwight Eisenhower sort of moderated that and tried to make them the party of the middle class. And in 1956, if you look at the young Republicans, they had posters talking about how, we're all in favor of labor and, we've expanded Social Security. And it was part of the Republican Party platform. You read the 1956 Republican Party platform. It was more moderate, but still they were the party of business, the party of the wealthy interests. And now they're just naked about it. They don't care what anybody thinks. Terry, thank you for the call. Mark in Chico, California. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark? No, Mark. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. So I was going to ask Senator Sanders if he thought it was possible a bill could go through that required that all landfills collect their methane and use the power to reduce electricity. Because I was thinking, we've got to send these things through without them knowing what they're really doing. Because when they know, they fight it. But yeah. If we could send it through as an environmental bill through. Without them knowing that that's what they're passing.
Yeah, they'll figure it out. They've got all these think tanks. They got all these people. They got Senator DeMint. Has retired early to run the Heritage Foundation. They are going to. I don't think such a thing could happen.
Anything that they can.
Yeah.
So then I was listening to people. We often call and say, Congress, what are you doing? And I just wanted to say, if anybody's listening, what are we doing? We really need to make, at least once a month, an occupation. If your town is big enough to have a mayor, we need to have an occupation in every town across this country at least once a month. We need to be making phone calls. We need to be writing letters. And we need to get together on whatever social network we can find each other and get that done. Because if we're not doing that, they can't do anything either.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I advocate an inside-outside strategy. The outside strategy is joining groups like Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, MoveToAmend.org, to push forward a constitutional amendment, Public Citizen, .org. There's a bunch of great groups out there that are kind of on the outside that you can join and be part of. And many of them, like Progressive Democrats of America and MoveToAmend, you can create a local chapter, even if there's only 300 people in your town. Number one. And then on the inside strategy is show up at your local Democratic Party meetings and run for a precinct committee person and become one of the people who helps write the party platform and who helps decide who are going to be the primary candidates. This is how the right-wingers took over the Tea Partiers took over the Republican Party. And we can do it with the Democratic Party, and we should be. So it's a matter of showing up.
You keep up the good work, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot, Marcy. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening. Much appreciated. But we do. We need to get active. It's, sitting around talking about this stuff. It's nice, but it's really not where it gets real is when you actually show up. Whether it's showing up, as Marcia said, occupying as it were, just showing up for. It doesn't have to be confrontational. Be very friendly, very cordial with your local mayor's office, your city council's office, your school board's office, your every one of us, except those of us in D.C., you have a member of Congress who can vote, and they have local offices. You can show up there.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The True People's Media. Mark in Orlando, Florida. You wanted to talk about Keystone and the Senate budget bill?
Yeah, Tom. I just received an email from the 350.org group, Bill McKibben,
right,
et cetera. And they're appraising everybody that right now there's an amendment that was added to the current budget bill to approve the Keystone XL pipeline through the budgetary process.
Right.
So, like another item that I'm not sure people know about, the Monsanto rider, the number 735 that's currently on the same budget bill, are the way the corporations are taking over behind our back,
yep,
and playing some evil deck.
I agree. I saw the same email. The one that I had said, call Senator Bill Nelson down in Florida, that he's on the fence. And one of the people on our staff is from Florida and has a Florida phone number on her cell phone, and called Senator Nelson's office to say what's going on, what are you going to do? And Senator Nelson's office said, don't know. So I don't know if, sometimes these mass emails go out and they identify people by, where they voted or where they used to live. And she came from Florida, so that might be why it said Senator Nelson. Did yours have an individual senator identified in it?
Yeah, it did have Senator Nelson, and I already contacted his office.
Of course, you're in Orlando, too. You're in Florida, too. So,
yeah.
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 It may be that if you were in New Jersey, it would have been Menendez. I don't know. I just don't know. But I think now is a good time for everybody to be calling their senators and saying, they're having this vote-a-thon this afternoon in the Senate, and they're going to try and get through as much pot as they can. And you're absolutely right. There is a proposed amendment to approve the Keystone XL pipeline and attach it to the budget bill. And if my understanding is correct, budgets can be passed by reconciliation. They can't be filibustered. And this could be a real messy thing. So let's not get this amendment into the budget bill to begin with. I'm totally with you, Mark. And thanks for calling and raising the alarm bell on this. If you go to callcongress.org, there's some phone numbers you can use, including the main number for the switchboard in Congress. And if you're not sure who represents you, this is happening in the Senate. If you're not sure who your two senators are, just tell whoever answers the phone what state you're from, and they will tell you who your senators are, and then they will connect you with whichever one you choose. And you can call back after you're done and talk to the other one's office. Because every outside of the District of the Goddess, the District of Columbia, everybody else has two senators. So, Mark, good luck. Thanks a lot for the call. Craig in Crestview, Florida. We got a lot of calls from Florida today. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Well, I got a question on how you would actually work the mechanic side of ending billionaires. I mean, you mm-hmm. just take an example of somebody like Bill Gates, worth 50 or 60 billion.
Right.
40 billion of that's actually probably in his valuation of stock.
Right.
Are you just planning on seizing that stock and giving it to the federal government to manage, or is he going to distribute his stock out to the poor? Because we sure can't afford to buy it. I mean, you realize that the lower 90%, since they don't hold that stock, they can't buy it at the right cost. So are you going to devalue the stock and crash the market? How are you actually going to work that? And are you going to work it worldwide so, like, the Prince of Dubai doesn't buy all that stock for pennies on the dollar?
Yeah. Craig, those are great questions, and I don't have an answer to any of them. I just want to start the conversation. I think that we need to have a conversation in the United States about how much wealth is enough that it hits the point that Thomas Jefferson defined as dangerous to a republic, was the phrase that he used, dangerous to democracy. How much wealth is so great that it can corrupt our political processes? And, you know, I've relatively arbitrarily suggested that it should be at least 900, you know, anything over $999,999,999.99. And that if you can't live on $1 billion of the net worth, then, you know, we all have a problem, including you. Whether it should just be the liquid wealth that somebody has. I mean, you know, again, are you going to force somebody to sell all their vacation homes? Are you going to force them to sell the town in Switzerland that they own? I don't know. I don't have any easy answer to this thing. But I do think that we should have the conversation about this. And that's what our No Billionaires campaign was really trying to do, is start the conversation. How much wealth is so great? How much wealth is too much wealth for one person to have? Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind?
Hey, Brother Tom. What do you think of this angle? Okay, I don't believe for a second that whether they're Democrats or whether they're Republicans, whether they're in the House or whether they're in the Senate, believe for a second, if they were completely truthful and honest with themselves and us, that there is such a thing in this country for the majority of people to compete in, and globally on that spectrum too, of free trade and free markets. Because you know,
well, everybody knows it's a scam. There is no such thing.
Here's the best scam, sir, brother. Okay? If Congress truly believes in free trade and free markets, why don't they put up their jobs, their benefits, their retirements and lobby fees against the cheapest bidders instead of the highest before they cut Social Security and Medicare, the two programs that help the private sector contributors in our society the most.
Yeah.
The private sector contributors.
Somebody called earlier, Armin, asking why doesn't, you know, if Congress is going to chain the CPI, why don't they chain their own pay, you know, why, if they're going to have the sequester and they're going to cause federal workers to go to 4 days a week, why don't they go to 4 days a week in terms of pay anyway? They're already at 4 days a week in terms of work or less. And the simple answer is that there's an amendment to the Constitution, I think it's the 27th Amendment, which says that any change in congressional pay can only take effect in the next Congress. And it was intended to prevent congressmen and women from raising their own pay, but it also prevents them from lowering their own pay. So the simple answer is that it can't be done legally right now. You'd have to amend the Constitution to allow it to happen.
I disagree with that.
I wouldn't have put it in the Constitution. I think it's a shame that it's there, but you can't, look it up. You can't disagree with the reality of it being there. And that's, you know, when Bernie was saying, don't refer to us as you guys. Well, first of all, yeah, Bernie Sanders is a very different man than Rand Paul, for example. But that said, both of them are senators and they can't vote on their own pay. They can only vote on the next Congress's pay. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Cover a whole variety of topics as we go through the days. Stay with us. Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And as the Senate is having, literally they're calling this thing a votorama right now. We'll see what comes out of this. Billy in Dallas, Texas. You wanted to talk about capital gains?
I did, Tom. Yeah, what prompted my call was I heard you last week interviewing a gentleman at CPAC, and he was arguing against taxing capital gains at the income tax rates because it was double taxed. And your argument back to him on that was that any money that comes out has already been taxed in some form or another, so that really doesn't matter.
And an easy example is I pay income tax on my paycheck. Does that mean I should be able to walk into a store and say I'm not going to pay sales tax?
Sure. But I think there's a much more succinct way to make that argument and have it cut through things,
Okay. Which
is that any money that you receive in capital gains, you haven't paid any taxes on anyway. If you buy a house for $1 million and then you sell it for 1.1, you're going to pay capital gains on $100,000.
Right.
And that's $100,000 you never paid tax on anyway.
Right. Yeah. So why not tax that at ordinary interest rate or ordinary income rates?
Agree completely.
Yeah.
I think that's a better way to argue it, and makes it much simpler.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. The capital gains tax, as applied to a capital gain, like, hey, your house became worth more, or the stock in your portfolio became worth more, that's a lot easier to argue the way that you're arguing it. What he was arguing was the, you know, taxing dividends as capital gains. And the whole rationale behind this is dividends are money that corporations distribute after they have declared their profit, after they've paid tax on that profit, and they still have money left over, and therefore it's already been taxed. In theory, the fact of the matter is that a quarter of the profitable corporations in America that are, you know, larger than billion-dollar corporations pay no taxes at all anyway, and they still distribute dividends. So, you know, more often than not, it's not even taxed. But and then you've got carried interest. You've got these guys on Wall Street who say, well, you know, we should be taxed at the capital gains rate because we made our money in the stock market, and we're calling it carried interest, which is this bizarre little, you know, world of income that only applies to people basically churning stock, and that's another giant loophole. But your point is well taken, Billy. It's very well taken. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing it. Catherine in New York City. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I live on Social Security, and without the chain CPI, I will be hungry. And I'm wondering if I went into a store.
You mean with the chain CPI? If they put into place the chain CPI and it starts cutting your Social Security benefits?
I'm talking about the cost of living.
Oh, okay. The COLAs.
And if I go into a store and steal a can of cat food to eat, I'm wondering what my fine would be, since it's nonviolent crime. It seems that those on Wall Street and banks pay a very small fee compared to their crimes. So I'm wondering if all nonviolent crimes shouldn't be a fee. I should pay like one-third of the cat food.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Well, you know, if we're going to apply the same rules that we apply to banksters to average working people, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
because
I will definitely go hungry.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Catherine. This is, you know, we do need to have cost of living adjustments for Social Security. They do need to reflect the actual cost to seniors and disabled people. And keep in mind, a third of Social
Security has gone up so high,
yeah.
I can barely keep up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't need another cat food commission, another Simpson Bowles. Catherine, thank you for the call. Your point is very, very well made. Jerry in Amityville, New York, also listening on WWRL. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. How you doing? Yeah, I'd like to discuss the new proposed gun laws in Congress and what's happening with them.
Yeah.
And
they're dropping like flies.
Excuse me?
They're dropping like flies.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, the problem with passing into law any of the common sense reforms of our nation's gun laws that the president called for in the State of Union speech, I think the problem was best described by Al Gore in the January 31st interview he did on Public TV's NewsHour program. And he said verbatim that Congress is virtually incapable of passing any reforms unless they first get permission from the powerful special interests who are most affected by the reforms.
Right.
And I think we see ample evidence of this with respect to what's going on in Congress now. And if we look at the difficulty that Senator Feinstein is having in getting her gun industry opposed assault weapons ban included in a basic package of legislation that's supposed to address this problem of gun violence in this country. And the whole irony is the call for new gun laws all started, as we know, with what happened in Newtown, Connecticut. And what happened in Newtown, Connecticut is we had a school shooting in which an individual got his hands on a weapon that's modeled after the M16,
right.
Which
is a weapon of war
for a battlefield.
Right.
And he loaded it up with tons of ammunition. I don't know if it was 100 rounds or 20 rounds, but a lot more rounds than he needed. And the result is we have a lot of adults and innocent children who are dead. And even after that, the NRA is so powerful now that we cannot even get a ban reintroduced that they used to be in this country.
No, I'm totally with you, Jerry. And it's not just the NRA, by the way, that's powerful. The NRA is just the front group. It's like the old National Smokers League or, you know, Smokers Rights Association. The NRA is just a front group. Wayne LaPierre is just a, you know, he's paid $1 million a year to be a spokesman. It's actually the gun manufacturers. And you know, under this legislation that was passed back during the Bush administration, they have immunity from lawsuits, unlike the tobacco industry. I mean, you know, they're the only industry in the United States that has that immunity. It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. Jerry, thank you for the call. Michael, in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, you had a question about God bless you?
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Hartman? Actually, it's about sneezing, you know, and it's sort of about the feeling that we all feel when somebody beats you to saying God bless you to somebody who just sneezed.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering where you think that originated. And I'll give you my opinion afterwards.
Okay. My understanding, and I, you know, I may be wrong on this, but my understanding is that back before Van Leeuwenhoek invented the microscope in the, 1700s, 1720s, that there was this belief, and in fact, probably, you know, hundreds of years before that, thousands of years maybe, there was a belief that illness was brought on by demonic spirits or by bad spirits or by evil spirits. And that when a person sneezed, first of all, we have a, you know, humans have a long history of noticing correlation and assuming causation out of that. And so, you know, we noticed that people would sneeze and then a few days later they'd be really sick. And, you know, because sneezes usually precede things like colds and flu. And so the assumption became that during that moment of the sneeze, there's all these theories, you know, the heart stops, the body, you lose control of your body for a second, and that during that moment of the sneeze, the demons might be able to jump inside you. And so if you say God bless you, that would make the demons pop back out of you. And, you know, now we know that, you know, it's demonic forces are not what cause the common cold, but we still say God bless you. Now, that's my understanding. It could be totally wrong. What's yours?
My thought is that somebody who had really prominence in the society, you know, was really well respected, he sneezed and that was enough to make him die. And ever since that event happened in that community, whatever, I don't know, you know, but because somebody who was really respected, when he sneezed, he died. And everybody just from then on just got freaked out and said, God bless you.
Yeah. Well, that's not inconceivable. I mean, it's sneezing can, it's rare. But a sneeze can provoke a heart attack, or a repeated sneezing can lead to some serious problems. But I'm more inclined toward my theory than yours. But either one of us could be right, or we could both be wrong. Probably somebody on our message board will lay out all the details on this. Michael, thanks for the call. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just, you know, wanted to comment on something that you had said a few weeks ago about America's Taliban and then the coming together of the religious right and corporations. And in a sense, even though they're not advocating violent overthrow of our system, they're doing quite a bit of violence to us in the sense that they don't respect the very fundamentals of which this government was based on, which is rationality. So I'm sure you probably have plenty to comment on that.
The parallels between the Taliban and the conservatives, basically?
You know, you had mentioned that the religious right, it's a Taliban in a sense.
Yeah, there's a Taliban mentality. There's a, they think they know best and they want to impose their way of life on other people, and they use religion as the rationale.
Exactly. And then corporations are inherently undemocratic in a sense.
Right, they're kingdoms.
The way that they're buying off our government. And these two forces within the Republican Party have come together.
Yes.
And so in a sense, it's like a quiet coup. You know, somebody actually did, you know, a very British coup. It was an interesting program where it showed that, you know, basically within British society, nothing really has changed from the Middle Ages. That there's still the people running, pulling the strings, and then the rest of them.
Yeah.
And so I think that we have kind of a problem, you know, in a sense that, you know, they are undermining the very principles of our government. And, you know, in the 60s, you know, violent overthrow of the government was verbatim. You know, it was
I got it, John.
John, we're out of time, but thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I don't think in the 60s violent overthrow of the government was being advocated by more than just a few on the very, very edge fringes. It's not the norm. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Chad in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Chad, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I appreciate your views. I just wanted to comment on the limiting the magazine size on these assault weapons and things like that, and the arguments made in both back and forth. How you got the gun proponents? They don't want the size limited, but most of these hunters can't go in the woods with their shotgun and with 9 rounds in their barrel and shoot up all these ducks. So it's just funny how there's this argument that we don't want our size limited, but they're already voluntarily doing this.
Well, most hunters, most NRA members are in favor of limits on the size of ammunition clubs.
Right. Well, earlier in the day, I was listening to what was occurring in New York where they wanted it limited to 10 rounds or whatever the case is. And it's just, it's just the hypocrisy. This is how, the common sense of this is just getting distorted into different views. Yeah. And I would just consider myself as a free thinker more than a conservative or a liberal. I just can't believe how people can't look at the common sense of an issue anymore, and instead of picking a side for their own personal biases or whatever the case is, and just do the right thing, regardless if it's, 5 rounds or 100 rounds. It's the common sense is that, there's no need for a lot of this stuff, and with the money and everything that's being made for it, the political, posturing and the capital that's being made off this stuff. I mean, it's just real disappointing.
I would say speaking as somebody who's spent a fair amount of time with guns and I've shot a whole lot of them in a whole different variety of forms and formats, never at anything living, but I've shot a lot of guns. That if you need more than 9 or 10 rounds to protect yourself, in quotes, you probably should not be carrying a gun if you're that bad a shot.
Absolutely, or you're in the military. The sole purpose of that, to have that much, is doing maximum damage, and I just can't see where the mentality comes from.
Right. Yeah, and that's not self-defense. That's on the battlefield. On the battlefield, the rules of war are quite different, and the circumstances of war are quite different. And then you get these people going, Chicago's a war. No, it's not a war zone. It's a city.
Right. So that was just my comment, Tom. Yeah. I was just listening.
I'm with you, Chad. I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the rationality. And call your two senators and your member of the House of Representatives from Pittsburgh and let them know where you stand. Appreciate the call. Jim in Johnstown, New York. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Just a couple of quick comments. Generally a conservative voter, but I would like to see the filibuster rules done away with, because I also believe in accountability, and I think that people ought to vote for what they believe in and stand behind it.
I agree, and I believe in the Constitution. The Constitution says that laws shall be passed when a majority of both houses of Congress agree on them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the filibuster is arguably unconstitutional.
We agree on, but I kind of wonder what would happen, if those rules did change, because I think an example of it you're saying right now is Harry Reid's stance on the assault weapon ban. He's basically, not standing behind conviction. I'm kind of wondering, no matter what side of Congress it would be, if the filibuster rules weren't in place, if that would change the voting dynamic, because people would still be afraid at that point in time to vote conviction.
Yeah, I don't think that the assault weapons ban has anything to do with the filibuster, Jim. My understanding from what Harry Reid said was he couldn't get even 40 votes for it, and he would need 51 votes, and that's if it wasn't being filibustered.
True, but it's a matter of conviction. If he had the conviction to have an assault weapon ban, it wouldn't matter how many votes he had. He puts it up for a conviction. That's why I think that, people, you guys,
Well, he can't put it up for a vote if it's being filibustered. And that's your point. You do away with the filibuster, and he can then put it up for a vote and let the chips fall
absolutely
where they may.
And
yeah, okay. I don't disagree with you.
Where they may, but
yeah.
I wonder if the politicians would kind of have a comfort level having a filibuster there, because they really don't have to have it happen.
Of course. They can blame their cowardice on the other side.
Yeah.
So both sides can.
There you
actually
go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm with you, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm terrified by what's going on in Cyprus right now, the prospect of bankers literally taking part of depositors' accounts to pay for their gambling in the derivatives arena.
You know, the bankers in the United States can do that legally.
They can?
They can, yeah. And
I didn't know they'd even – well, have they actually attempted this bold move before?
No. Well, they've done it in the past. I mean, they did it before we had federal deposit insurance. When the banks were all failing in the late 1920s, early 1930s, very often the bankers would pay off themselves. They would pay off their stockholders. They would make everybody whole except the depositors, and then they'd declare the bank bankrupt, and the depositors got screwed. They'd take 100%. And that's why people who lived through the 30s very often didn't keep money in banks. They literally kept it under their mattress. And I'm thinking, I've got a little bit of money in the bank. Maybe I should be taking it out in cash and put it in $100 bills and stash it someplace, get a safety deposit box or something. I mean, go ahead.
This leads me even to more questions. My first question was, do you know whether they have credit unions over in Cyprus?
I don't know.
Are those exempt? Okay,
yeah.
You don't know that.
I don't know.
Do you know whether they have the equivalent of this FDIC insurance that we do have?
They do. They do. I confirmed that last night with with Richard Wolff, the professor of economics at the New School in New York City. And he said that what they did was basically they have deposit insurance, and the deposit insurance has a loophole in it that allows the banks to basically go around it, that the deposit insurance is there more to protect the banks than to protect the depositors. And he said there's a similar loophole in American law.
Okay. Well, what this
grim stuff
basically points, it seems to me like the reason I asked about the credit unions is I think that we're going to have to start thinking about, in order to fight the corporatocracy, basically building our own institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Right now you have the FLCIO trying to link up with that big Spanish co-op firm to, start some kind of co-ops in this country.
Mondragon.
People in other parts of the world might have to start setting up their own banking institutions.
Yep.
I mean, it's us against them, and we have to figure out a way to fight them.
I agree. And this is, local banks, local SNLs, local credit unions. And beyond that, I think every state in the union should do what North Dakota has done and create a state bank. If California had a state bank, they would have so much money because they have so much money flowing through the California government that is being all handled by like Citicorp and JP Morgan and whatnot. And if they simply created a state bank, the banking is profitable. If the interest that they were paying to themselves, they could lower taxes, or they could invest in infrastructure. They could build out a world class broadband system or whatever. It's like we need to have state banks as well. We'll do that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And 6 minutes past the hour. Get my earpiece in here. Figure out what's going on. There we go. Okay, Anything Goes Friday. And Tressa. Am I saying that right? In Severn, Maryland?
Yes, Tressa.
Hey, what's up?
I was actually going to tell you the history of the God Bless You. It is actually from the bubonic plague.
Oh, really?
Sneezing was thought around the time of Pope Gregory. Sneezing was thought to be like the first symptom.
Uh-huh.
So they would say God bless you to kind of ward off those evil vapor spirits and so on and so forth. But
right.
Usually most people died, so at least it was a blessing, right?
Yeah. So
that's the actual history.
Oh, interesting. So my theory had some basis in
some basis. Yes.
Very
yes.
Interesting.
But as soon as I heard it, I was like, plague, say it.
It was the bubonic plague. Very interesting.
Exactly. The other point that I wanted to make, I'm a first-time caller, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And other thing is I was listening to a gentleman on Sirius Left talking about the drones. And I actually kind of agree with his point is Americans kind of have a tendency to be against something if it comes to us, but they're not so against it if it's used on other people. And to me, it's like if you're against a drone or you're not against a drone. The other thing that I kind of see from a pacifist standpoint is after World War II, America kind of became a really bad segue from a military defense program into a militant mercenary force. Mm. And this is kind of how I see it, because I have European roots, and it's like, to me, America has a tendency to want to go in and fix everything for everyone when we have so many problems here in this country. So that was basically my point.
Yeah, the kind of a sense of entitlement associated with empire. With regard to drones, my perspective on it is that drones themselves are simply a technological move forward. I mean, we started out with regard, you know, the history of aerial warfare is that originally it was catapults that we would use to, like, throw a bucket of burning oil over a castle wall. And then we figured out how to use balloons. And then we got, blimps. And then we got airplanes.
Oh, I agree.
We've got drones. So it's the technology.
Exactly. I mean, there's a difference between being an idealist and a realist. Mm-hmm. You know, the ideal would be that we didn't need these things, but reality is a whole different story. I just kind of feel like sometimes we are, in so many ways, becoming so desensitized to killing in general.
Yeah, I agree. And my concern is not with drones, it's with the application of them. And I think this is true of any technology, whether it's, you know, fighter jets or whether it's, you know, weather balloons, whatever. It's the use of them. If we're going to weaponize drones and we're going to fly them over areas anywhere, inside the United States, outside the United States, and we're going to assassinate people without due process of law, we have violated our own core principles and our own constitution. And
exactly, because I wasn't
simple.
Quite sure how this was playing out with bringing the gentleman over to New York to be tried in court.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, what, this one is entitled to due process, but another isn't?
Right.
It just didn't make any sense to me.
No, it makes no sense to me either, and I think it makes no sense to most Americans. And I think that we're going to look back on this. You know, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt did a lot of wonderful things, but imprisoning the Japanese was not one of them. There is that blot on his administration. And I think that the drone policy, the Obama administration, continuing the drone policy, the Bush administration, is going to be a blot on his administration when we look back on it. I think it's very unfortunate, and I hope that they change it. Tressa, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Dan in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yes, hello. First, I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
I can.
A few days ago, weeks ago, the Justice Department, I believe it was the Attorney General himself, that said that the reason that they cannot prosecute the banks, the big banks, is due to the fact that they didn't want the economy to falter. And I have a very difficult time coming to terms with such a rationale, which I call an excuse, because I think big banks should be broken up, but that's not the point. That's step number two. Step number one, if you have somebody at the top management, CEOs, that break the law, and you replace them, you are not really ruining, stopping business. If there is some airport that's being using bank money to be constructed, that can go on just because you replace the guy on top with a warning to not be a crook.
Yep.
So I don't see anybody pursuing the discrepancy between there's a logical hole in here.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. When Ronald Reagan was confronted with the consequences of his own mistake. In 82, Reagan deregulated SNL. So it was one of these grand experiments, right? Greenspan's idea, in fact, right? Ravi Batra writes about it in his book, Greenspan's Fraud. So Reagan deregulates the SNLs, and guess what? 4 years later, you got all these speculators and hustlers, people like Neil Bush, George W. Bush's brother. He was with Silverado, the one in Colorado. They basically blew up the SNLs. They stole everything they could and crashed them into the ground. So what did Ronald Reagan do? With the exception of Neil Bush, who got a pass because he was the son of the vice president, what Reagan did is he investigated over 1,000 of them. He put a special prosecutor on them. He sent several hundred of them to jail, some quite famously. He took all of the SNLs and caused all of their stockholders to lose all of their investments to keep the depositors from being burned and nationalized them. And then he hired a guy by the name of Bill Seidman, or Seidman, S-E-I-D-M-A-N, who just recently passed away, who did some brilliant conversations on YouTube about this that you can find. He hired Bill Seidman to start this thing called the Resolution Trust Corporation that took ownership of the SNLs and unwound the bad debt that they had over time and sold them back into the private market and, you know, reprivatized them. And it took almost 15, 20 years for the whole process to happen. And by the time they were done, the federal government had shown a profit on it. The people who had put money in SNLs never noticed any problems. And like I said, the banksters themselves, a bunch of them went to jail, and the people who were investing in these SNLs because they thought, hey, you know, look at how much money these guys are making. This is a money machine, you know. This has got to be too good to be true. Well, it was too good to be true. And they got screwed.
My point is that can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I'm just saying, you know, why won't Obama do what Reagan did?
He was not my hero, and he did that part. The fact that he went after the crooks was a good thing.
Yeah.
But the thing that bothers me is that we are not getting the complete answer or an explanation.
Yeah. Well, the easy answer, Dan, is Elizabeth Warren has been pointing this out, and she campaigned on this and won a Senate seat in Massachusetts on it, that the game is rigged. The game is rigged from the get-go, that if you're a rich banker, and more likely than not a rich white banker, and by rich, I'm talking not just a couple million in the bank, but hundreds of millions, tens of millions, billions in the bank, then there's a whole different set of rules, especially if you're a large political donor, than there are for, you know, a guy who runs a local check-cashing service. You know, they were busting some of these local small Muslim check-cashing services that were wiring money back to Pakistan, where people would send money back to their families for so-called involvement with Al-Qaeda. But HSBC in the United States, you know, the seventh largest bank in the world, comes in, and they're laundering $600-700 million for Mexican and Colombian drug lords and laundering money for terrorist groups, which may Iran, Sudan. Bashir, the head of Sudan, is an indicted war criminal and possibly Al-Qaeda. And what do they get? They get a slap on the hand. They get a fine. Nobody goes to jail. I think it's wrong. I'm with you, Dan, on that. I totally agree. Thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think it was Elizabeth Warren who said, too big to fail has become too big to jail, and that's wrong. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Sally in Lincoln City, Oregon. Hey, Sally, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Just this Monday, watching Rachel Maddow, I learned about the Johnson declassified tapes on what Nixon had done to subvert the peace talks.
Yeah,
the
Paris
peace talks.
Yep.
And it's the first time I've heard about it, and it just makes me so angry about what Nixon had done. And because it really shows that 20,000 lives could have been saved if the peace talks had been carried through.
Yep.
And I just wondered what you thought about this.
I have ranted extensively about this in the past, Sally. I've written a couple of op-eds on it over the years. When the tapes were first released, which was only about 3 or 4 years ago, as I recall, we were among the first to play them and play them fairly aggressively. I think that we need to have this should be written in our history books that Richard Nixon committed treason. Now that you've got last week in the Christian Science Monitor, you had the former president of Iran, a fellow by the name of Bonnie Sauter, who wrote an op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor saying that when he was president, he was elected president of Iran during the hostage crisis, and he wanted to free the hostages, but the Ayatollah had cut a deal with the Reagan campaign to hold the hostages until after the election so that Jimmy Carter would be defeated in 1980. And so you've got the Reagan campaign doing the exact same thing that the Nixon campaign did. And both of those campaigns should be outed as being traitors. Ronald Reagan's campaign, run by Bill Casey, and I don't remember who ran Richard Nixon's campaign, These guys are traitors. And here's a tape of Lyndon Johnson. He has intercepted the conversations between the Nixon campaign and the guys out of New Mexico who were helping run it and the people in Vietnam. And he calls up Everett Dirksen, who's the senior Republican in the United States Senate and a man of great integrity, actually, and one of the last of the good Republicans, calls up Everett Dirksen and says, you know, this is treason, Everett, and I know what they're doing and I know what they're up to. And he's begging Everett to get to Richard Nixon. And in a later call, Everett, you know, calls him back and says, I communicated this to Nixon, and Nixon basically told me to take a hike. And Nixon obviously continued with the deal and blew up the peace talks. But here's the initial conversation between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen. It's mind-boggling. Here it is.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
And that's Everett Dirksen, the head Republican in the United States Senate. After the president says this is treason, Everett Dirksen says, I know. And this is a tape that every American should have heard. And this is, you know, this is probably the 100th time I've played it over the years. But Sally, you're absolutely right. And the question, in fact, I did a whole op-ed on this on TV a couple of weeks ago that is out on YouTube, where we played this and we played the stuff from, you know, or reported on what Bonnie Sauter has said. Now he's in his 70s. He wrote the op-ed. He didn't go do media about it, but he lives in Paris. Where he said that the Reagan administration or the Reagan campaign did the exact same thing and blew up the hostage negotiations so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election in 1980. And I asked the question, has there been, and then you, on top of that, George W. Bush won the White House because the Supreme Court stopped the recount in Florida. And a year later, when the New York Times counted all the votes statewide in Florida, they found that by any measure, pregnant Chads, dimpled Chads, overvotes, undervotes, pimpled Chads, intent of voter, whatever, by any measure, Al Gore won Florida, but the Supreme Court stole that election for George W. Bush. And so here's the question. Is it possible, and I think it is, that the last Republican who was elected legitimately without treason or without intervention by the Supreme Court, which is damn close to treason, was Dwight Eisenhower? What do you think? Sally?
Yes, yeah. I'm still here.
Okay, well, that's my rant. And Sally, thank you for the call. I genuinely believe that Dwight Eisenhower was the last Republican who was legitimately elected. And you can say, well, George Bush Sr., you know, he won, but he wouldn't have been, you know, in a position to run if he hadn't been vice president. So that follows on to Ronald Reagan's, you know, stealing the election in 1980. So you've got Reagan, Bush and Nixon, all four of them were illegitimate presidencies. And look at the damage that they have done to the United States. 32 years of Reaganomics. Mind-boggling damage. Wiped out the middle class, enriched the Carlyle Group, Bush Sr.'s buddies, enriched Halliburton, Dick Cheney's buddies. I mean, it is mind-boggling. Well, it is, as Lyndon Johnson described Everett Dirksen, treason. And he said, I don't want this to get in the campaign, Everett. The American people will be shocked. And that's why Lyndon Johnson took that to his grave, as did Hubert Humphrey, who was running against Nixon in that election in 1968. Humphrey was the vice president of the United States. Humphrey was, involved in the negotiations with Vietnam. He didn't, or not directly, but he had knowledge of them. He knew that LBJ had negotiated an end to the Vietnam War in 1968. And when it was going to be announced in September, October, and Humphrey would have easily won the election. But Nixon blew it up and came into office saying, I got a secret plan to end the war. And then 4 years later, the war was still going, and he had a secret plan all over again in 1972 to end the war. And Henry Kissinger was in on this one. He's got it all figured out. This is treason. In my opinion, the last legitimately elected Republican president of the United States was Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. And what was the campaign platform that Eisenhower ran on? You got that clip, Shane?
and play it as we come out of this bump here. When we come back in just a second, I'm going to play for you the campaign slogan. Just do the last 15, 20 seconds of it, of Dwight Eisenhower running for president in 1952, the last time a Republican was legitimately elected president of the United States. What was his campaign slogan? Stick around for just a second and you'll hear it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace.
Well, it's getting weirder and weirder. Somebody, first of all, these young women in the Dominican Republic, you know, Bob Menendez, Senator Menendez, the Democrat from New Jersey, has a friend who is a fairly wealthy guy who's got a home in the Dominican Republic, and he's gone down there and basically partied with him hung out with him, friends, whatever. And so the story was that Menendez was getting it on with hookers down there. And these three hookers came out and said, yeah, I was paid to have sex with the guy. Then, and this was released by the Daily Caller, a website owned by Tucker Carlson. Then it turns out that the women come out and say, no, we actually didn't have sex with Menendez. You know, as it becomes a federal case. I mean, it literally, as the federal government starts looking into it, because if he had done that, that could be a crime. And you know, now they're saying, oh, no, we were paid to say that. We never even met the guy. And so then the question is, okay, who paid you? And they're like, well, this lawyer. And so now the lawyer is saying the Daily Caller paid him $5,000. And the Daily Caller has come out and said, no, we didn't do that. But the story's getting weirder and weirder. You know, and this is like, you know, Breitbart. This is like James O'Keefe. You know, it's like set somebody up, take them down, like the way O'Keefe did with Acorn, with complete phony baloney stuff, and then just like run. You know, get out of the way and look at the wreckage. And Bob Menendez's reputation is in tatters for something that he had nothing to do with and didn't do. And we will see if this, you know, communicates itself to these websites or these news organizations. The lawyer is suggesting the CNN, the Spanish version of CNN, Telemundo, Univision, and Daily Caller all offered to pay him, and the Daily Caller actually sent a guy named Carlos down to the Dominican Republic, gave him $5,000 to find some women to lie that they were being paid to have sex with Congressman Menendez or Senator Menendez. It just doesn't get more weird than this. I mean, this is American and this at the same time that we're talking about the Reagan administration, you know, having the Ayatollah hold the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election, the Nixon administration having the South Vietnamese refuse to go to the Paris peace talks so that Lyndon Johnson's protege and Vice President Hubert Humphrey would lose the election to Richard Nixon, and the Supreme Court deciding 5-4 to make it illegal for the Supreme Court of the state of Florida to order its, you know, to continue counting all the votes in the state to find out whether George Bush won Florida. It turns out he didn't. And thus the U.S. Supreme Court handing the election off to George W. Bush. Every Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower elected illegitimately. And it's all dirty tricks. This is how these guys win elections. And I played the clip of that Eisenhower ad. I'm going to play it one more time, and then I'll pick up your calls again just in case you didn't catch the end of it. As I was pointing out, the only Republican, the last Republican who was legitimately elected, I think, since, you know, 1930, which is, you know, a long, long time, in the last 80 years, in the last four generations, the only Republican who was legitimately elected president of the United States was Dwight Eisenhower. And Dwight Eisenhower ran on a campaign. Listen to the last couple words of this ad, because this was the campaign slogan of the Dwight Eisenhower campaign in 1952. Keep in mind, the Korean War was going on, and Eisenhower was running as the anti-war candidate. He was running as the Dennis Kucinich candidate. Here's the ad.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time.
November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. That was the last legitimately elected president, Republican president of the United States, in my opinion. Caleb in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
First of all, Tom, I love your classes on economics. And also what you're saying is always incredibly important, such as the Dirksen thing, the trader business and all that. And I agree with you, probably Eisenhower, the last cleanly elected president. But what do the righties say? How do they say that austerity is actually going to bring about jobs? If Boehner and Cantor and those wackos say it will bring about jobs, exactly how do they explain austerity itself will bring about jobs?
Here's their theory. Their theory is that if you get government out of the way, then private industry will step in and we'll do things more efficiently, and of course we'll hire more people. Now there's an inherent flaw in that right from the get-go, because if private industry is more efficient, it's going to operate with fewer employees, which means that there's going to be fewer jobs.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could I actually wrote an op-ed once called In Praise of Inefficiency, you know, that the government should be the employer of last resort, and if it's not efficient, so what? At least people have jobs. But setting that argument aside, this is their argument. And what they say, and I was debating a couple of libertarians on this just two nights ago on the TV show, was, you know, very simple, very straightforward. They, you know, turn the roads over to the billionaires, turn the hospitals over to the billionaires, turn all the schools over to the billionaires, turn the police and fire departments over to the billionaires, turn everything over to the billionaires except for the army, and you can and turn over everything that has to do with providing the army with anything to the billionaires, and the court system, and, you know, leave the army and the courts, and that's it. And you've got a libertarian paradise. You've got Ayn Rand's world, and the billionaires are so wise and so smart that they will do everything right. And in my mind, this is the old justification for royalty. This used to be the argument to have the king. You know, the king is the wise one. The king knows what's going on. Let the king run things and everything will be fine. And this was the model, you know, and the kings all said to the people, you know, without me, you'd be screwed. And so it's a nonsense argument, but that's their argument, is if government gets out of the way, private industry will step in. And I think, you know, if government gets out of the way, you're not going to have a fire department that functions. You're not going to have a police department that works the way it should. Look at what's happened when we privatized prisons. Now you've got private prison corporations lobbying for laws to put people in jail longer.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, murder rates in private prisons going through the ceiling. And you privatize schools. And what happens? Kids graduate not learning things. It's just, you know, and with far more student debt and more likely to default on that student debt and less likely to get a job, and on and on and on. I mean, I could just go down the list. I'm sure you know it as well as I do, but the commons should not be privatized. But that's their argument, Caleb, and frankly, they're wrong. It's tragic that so many young people actually believe this stuff, because they haven't, you know, been in the real world. They haven't seen how these things operate. They haven't seen the government bureaucracy and corporate bureaucracy are pretty much the same thing. Bureaucracies are bureaucracies. And you know, there's just not, you know, private and public, it's not just public sector bureaucrats are, you know, inefficient. And in fact, inefficiencies in corporate America can be even greater. We pay twice as much for health care as any country in the world. I mean, on a per capita basis. That's crazy. And that's because we're doing it on a for-profit basis. It's less efficient. Anyhow, Caleb,
well,
thanks for the call. Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Daryl in Denville, New Jersey. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. You wanted to talk about 3D printers?
Yeah, actually, every time I'm going to take you off speakerphone here real quick.
Thank you.
Yeah, having a problem with my new phone, sorry.
Okay.
Every time I hear somebody call in about limiting the size of magazines and about, banning assault weapons, I think to myself, a few years back, when 3D printing technology first emerged, people sort of laughed at it, like, oh, this is the Jetsons, this is never going to happen. Well, now you can go, there are companies that are selling 100 micron 3D printers. That's a micron, as you probably know, is 3.93 times 10 to the negative 5. That's 0.0000393 inches for a micron. That's high resolution. That's the best machine tool you can find. And so when we talk about these laws and limiting access to handguns and assault weapons, I wonder if Congress is thinking about what the future is going to hold when any yahoo can buy a 3D printer and swap plans for high-capacity magazines and assault weapons as easily as sending an email address or an email.
Well, here's the thing, Daryl. If you extend the logic of that argument, why have any laws at all? I mean, any yahoo right now can counterfeit U.S. currency. It's not that difficult. And yet people don't do it. Why don't they do it? Because they don't want to go to prison for a long, long time. I think that, you know, this is the NRA's argument. You know, if you do away with all the guns, only criminals are going to have guns. Well, okay, then let's just do away with all laws, since only criminals ignore the laws. And that makes no sense.
No, I'm not arguing. What I'm arguing for is for Congress to not only look at the law as it needs to exist today, to stop, you know, weapons trafficking, guns. I'm talking about they need to be looking forward into the future and thinking about what the law needs to look like tomorrow.
Yeah, make possession of a high-capacity clip, regardless whether you made it out of a printer, a 3D printer, or whether you bought it from Acme Clip Company. Make possession of it as big a crime as possession of counterfeit currency. You will see people stop wanting them real quick. Just like nobody wants counterfeit currency or heroin, you know. I mean, yeah, there's a small population, I suppose, who wants heroin, and there will be a small population who wants these high-capacity clips. But you put some pretty draconian penalties in place, and people suddenly start going, don't think so. Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Friday Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And one of our callers today, and I would guess it's going to be in the next 15 minutes, is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, compliments of Stamps.com. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell, Nate Sweet, and Kurt Gardinier, to Alva Goldbrook for video production, to our webmasters, Jamie Holly and Nigel Peacock, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the various companies that syndicate or organizations that syndicate this program, Dow Global on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio on the non-commercial side, CRN Network on cable systems, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Seriously, thank you. We wouldn't be here without you. Gus in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Gus, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great conversation. I was hearing a couple calls back, the woman that saw the segment on Rachel Maddow where they brought up the LBJ tapes, and it was interesting that she was trying to compare this to the mishandling of the Iraq War intel.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, I wanted to compare notes, if there really was the political will in Congress or the White House right now to prosecute the Iraq War intel, which, you know, constitutes, I believe, treason if you're lying to Congress and saying that Iraq has WMD. If there's a smoking gun that we know of, for example, in the testimony of the book put out by CIA European Chief Tyler Drumheller, or Lawrence Wilkerson, who said he was willing to testify.
Yeah, he said that, he's talked on this show. This was Colin Powell's assistant. He's talked on this show about how they phonied up the, yeah.
Yeah, so, that was Colin Powell's chief of staff.
Yeah, so your question, first of all, let me say, Gus, I have not seen that Rachel Maddow segment. I've been playing the LBJ tapes on this program for 3 or 4 years, however long they've been out there, since the Johnson Library released them. But I don't have personal knowledge of the Rachel show other than having had a couple of callers tell me about it. So I can't speak directly to that, but what was your question?
Well, I was saying, if there was the political will to actually investigate or prosecute, and this might just be an exercise here, but what would be the closest thing to the smoking gun, you know, as far as lying to Congress and the American people,
right,
in the Iraq War intel? Because I've been studying this for years, and it seems like there's pretty good substantive evidence that show George Tenet and his chief of staff, John McLaughlin, withheld the proof that Curveball was lying.
Yeah.
The one eyewitness to WMD was lying the whole time.
Right. And I don't know what would be the smoking gun in that regard. I'm not a scholar of the Iraq War. You know, Rachel's done a really good job of putting together a documentary based on the book Hubris that was co-authored by David Korn and who's the other guy? Yeah, Michael Isikoff. The two of them put together this book, and that documentary is, you know, it's brilliant. Although I would take it a step farther, I would say this is treason. But, you know, I think it's fairly clear and fairly implicit in that. But all of that said, I go back to 1999, when George W. Bush was not even yet running for president, but was planning on running for president. And his mother and dad hired an old family friend, a fellow by the name of Mickey Herskowitz, who was a well-known author and a good ghostwriter. There are people who just make a living being ghostwriters, writing other people's biographies and autobiographies. And they had hired him to write A Charge to Keep, which was George W. Bush's autobiography, because you have to have an autobiography out if you're going to run for president, right? Obama did, you know, Dreams of My Father and all this kind of stuff. And so he wrote the first draft of A Charge to Keep. It wasn't suck up enough, you know, for George W. Bush, for his dad, and in his dad's opinion, so they hired somebody else to finish it. But he had about 100 hours of taped interviews with George W. Bush, and he spoke on the record with journalist Robert Perry and said, well, here, this is Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers and before Congress. Keep in mind, this is a year before George W. Bush is even running for president. Here's what he had to say to the guy who was writing his biography for him.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
And you'll recall when George Bush won his second term, the first thing he did was he said, "I've got all this political capital, and I'm going to spend it." And what he was going to spend it on was what he ran for Congress on back in 1977 in Texas and lost, and that was privatizing Social Security. So I think that's the original sin, Gus, is that this guy, his commerce secretary, whose name escapes me at the moment, but he wrote a book, you know, just 2-3 years into the Bush administration, saying that the very first cabinet meeting that they had, which was 2 or 3 days after George was sworn in, George, just out of the clear blue sky, first item of business was, how do we attack Saddam Hussein? You know, how do we invade Iraq? And everybody was like, why would you want to do that? What are you talking about? And he had this thing. He wanted to be a war president, and he thought if he could be a war president, he would get so much political capital from that, like James Madison talked about. You know, this is one of the flaws in our form of government, is that the commander-in-chief is the president, and if he exercises that power of commander-in-chief, he gets all these additional powers and emoluments was the word that, powers and emoluments was the word that, the phrase that Madison used. And you know, Madison warned us about it. Bush did it. That would be the point that I would start with. Gus, thanks for the call. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman program, we'll have all the latest news from the weekend, and Congress voted to keep Saturday mail service. But does that mean the USPS is saved? I don't know. We'll discuss that with Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.